From the authors of Committed, the guide to developing college-ready recruits from middle school through high school, we share with you Mentors of Baseball, a conversation between coaches, parents, student athletes, all about player development and the recruiting process.
Just don't want to overload you. Probably right now at about 22 questions. I don't know if we'll get to all of them, but some of them are similar in nature. I'll try to group those if I can.
Yeah, no, and I'm sure we'll find a natural flow too, as we normally do with these things.
Absolutely.
But I got to commend you guys, and I know Brian's on here too. I was going through your book the other day. I didn't get to read the whole thing, but the thing that really caught me was the – am I echoing on your end?
No.
Okay, cool. No. The thing that keeps getting me here is the develop your fit page, and that kind of sums up like where they're going to go in the next step, and it seems like you guys really nailed it here, so I love it.
I appreciate that. I'm sure Brian appreciates that. The whole thing that led us to the book, digressing real quick before as parents come on. So when you get asked a lot of questions as far as how to, when to, all of those types of things, and it's not like you're building a robot. We're dealing with young student athletes and parents trying to navigate. They're getting all this information. They're flooded with information. And so one of the things that led us to write the book was Brian is going through this now, living this as a parent. And so his questions to me, and Brian said, rather than creating a course, why don't we do this as a Q&A, and we'll do it as you were, if you were helping me with regard to Sammy. And so that's how the book transpired. So I appreciate you sharing that observation. I find that more people that are getting their way to the book are intrigued by the emphasis on the strength and condition component at the younger ages. When I say younger, 13, 14 years old.
Well, there's parallels to everything that you're doing in recruiting and everything that we're doing in training. With your own experience with kids, like everybody's on their own trajectory. And we have guys that touch 100 come into us and they don't hit our baseline metrics. And we have 14-year-olds that do. And it's, we're going to treat each one of those people as individuals. And if you don't hit certain strength metrics and you don't throw 92, then maybe you shouldn't be looking at D1 schools right now, maybe in a couple months from now when you're throwing harder. But if you're not projected well, then I feel like a lot of people spin their wheels and get caught up in the shiny objects of the whole recruiting process.
And that is, I would, hopefully Brian has this rolling taping, because that's an exact commentary that I would like to share sometime with parents, because we're always chasing the next rabbit, the next new idea. Instead of focusing in on the young man, the student athlete, and the foundation, and then branching off of the foundation, we're running around and chasing different technology-driven, analytic-driven, travel ball, team selection-driven, shiny, as you alluded to, shiny object. And really, at the end of the day, when you're chasing all these rabbits, you tend not to catch the one that you're really trying to catch. But you know what I want to let everybody know is Dr. Josh Heenan is going to be joining us tonight. It's 8:57 Eastern time. Josh is, I think, in Connecticut. At least I know him.
I am in Colorado. We have two locations in Connecticut, and I relocated out here with my wife and family about 8 months ago.
Fantastic. Congratulations. So for all you
thank you.
People that may be from Colorado, you now have Josh Heenan and your Dr. Josh Heenan in your backyard. So
call me
Josh. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that a few people make their way here at 9 p.m. Eastern time. People will continue to join us, especially from the West Coast. We do have some previously submitted questions that we'll start Josh off with. And then if you happen to have a question that you would like to have me ask, if I follow you and you follow me and I have some level of comfort with you, I will, if you want to hit request to speak, I will do that. But if you're someone new, out of respect for our guest, I try to handle the questions just so we don't have any curse words or any bad situations occurring. We do have children that listen to these podcasts as well as the live space itself. So I try to make sure that our questions are consistent and they do not offend anyone. So nothing personal. Throughout the podcast or the space, I will go back and I will read our direct messages. Brian is also with us. Brian is a co-host and he goes in and he reads questions as well. And so those that get filtered in, I will ask Dr. Josh on your behalf. And most people assume when we begin to talk strength, conditioning, and throwing, we're alluding to specifically pitchers, but all baseball players, all fielders, catchers, infielders, outfielders are throwing athletes. And oh, by the way, if your son happens to be a football player, anything pertaining to throwing is going to be covered here this evening. So this isn't just for pitchers, for those parents that sent me some questions here earlier. Interesting question that I haven't yet talked with Butch or Brian about, but I'm curious as to how people feel about this. I've had three people from Twitter send me a question pertaining to the possibility of putting our discussions and podcasts on other platforms. That's something that we discuss. I'm sure that it will happen at some point. I just don't know the time parameters, but that's something that Butch and Brian and myself do discuss on a regular basis. So we'll go ahead and get started here this evening. Welcome to the Mentors of Baseball Twitter space. Our guest tonight is, I know he doesn't want me to say it, but Dr. Josh Heenan, who works with all types of student athletes, Connecticut, and now, as I've just discovered, Colorado. Josh is a undergrad at Sacred Heart University. He also has his Master's of Science. And he's worked with a litany of professional athletes and college athletes and youth athletes for a number of years. I've been a fan of Josh. I read a lot of his social media blogs and things of that nature. One of the things that I try to do as a parent and as somebody that works with a lot of younger student athletes is try to stay up to speed with different training techniques and so forth. And as a dad, as a parent, when my youngest son specifically was 14 years old in eighth grade, I was seeking out strength and conditioning because I had a very good friend of mine, Rich Gedman, who used to play for the Boston Red Sox, now is a AAA coach, essentially say to me, and I just got a clip from Brian saying the same thing, but he said to me, "You wouldn't want your son to drive in a car without a license and not having any kind of training of any kind or any kind of driving education." He said, the same thing can be said as your son begins to get older and starts to throw harder. He has to have the physicality and the strength to be able to A, maintain that, and B, grow and nurture. First of all, I want to welcome you, Josh, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So I'm going to share this because I found this to be a cute little tidbit. And when Brian sent this to me, I got a little bit of a chuckle. And it's a cartoon. And I think this is maybe something that you would like to share with us. It says, "Do you have a license to throw hard? Throwing 90 miles an hour without the understanding of the strength metrics needed would be the equivalent of driving without a license or being negligent behind the wheel of an automobile, because that's how much power your body has. I'm just wondering, at what point do you begin to interact with parents or student athletes as it pertains to the strength component and the movement patterns that are necessary for throwing athletes?"
I'm gonna ask you first, is that one of my tweets that you're sharing, or is that just the comment to someone else? Because I actually have a whole list of things, and there's PowerPoints linked to a license to throw, and I basically have the categories there. So I wasn't sure if you're referencing that or just like your previous experience.
This is yours.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I wasn't sure. I was like, oh, wow. So yeah, I look at people moving. I look at everybody as a human first, and I often say athlete first, where we want to be able to see just the human being have the qualities to move well. So I have a almost 3-year-old, and someone asked me, like, "When are you going to start training him?" And I was like, I let him train all the time. Like, he runs around, he grabs a jungle gym, he moves, he does things. We put him in constraint drills where he wants to chase me, and I'm like, hey, grab something heavy, and then he runs after me, so he has to fight his body. We typically interact with a lot of families 13, 14 on, but we'll get people that come in younger either because the parents are trying to be super proactive or because they have an injury. And that's in this therapy setting, we see a lot of kids come in sub 9, 10, 11 years old, sub teenage years, that really need to just understand how their body moves a little bit better. And a lot of times in our stance is, I want you to go play other sports because you need to learn how to move as a human being first before you really just want to lock yourself into one movement category and really allow your brain to understand what's going to happen when you get in different positions.
Now, I have a question that's coming in now on that point. In your opinion, for all student athletes, I guess not just the younger student athletes, what's more important, being strong or stability and flexibility?
It's always you want more of what you don't have. And for our younger, super mobile, less powerful athletes, we want to get them stronger. If we have to categorize like girls and boys against each other, the guys probably need to spend more time on mobility as a general rule of thumb, and the girls need to get stronger. And so we really try to balance that and evaluate each individual. That doesn't mean that there aren't circumstances where you need to be able to have certain qualities to throw a particular way. If you're a high slotted arm guy and you're losing mobility in your shoulder, that's something we're going to address right away. But it really is it's a pendulum based on where you currently are and where you want to go. So that's how we attack it. We look at everybody as an individual.
Do you have any threshold, Josh? This is a question coming in from a parent, obviously, of a football player as well as a baseball player. But is there any correlation between the athlete that throws a football as a sport and the number of repetitions and the time that he would need to rest in order to participate as a throwing athlete with regard to baseball?
Something my good buddy Wayne Mazzonian, who's in here right now, I'm not sure if you know him.
I do.
Okay, yeah, good. He's the right person. You guys are very similar-minded. But something that Wayne and I agree a lot on, I believe, is throwing a football we use actually as an off-season drill for a lot of our throwers because the movement pattern is a little bit different and you're still building stability and you're working with a quote-unquote weighted ball, which is a whole other topic. But you're working with a 15, 16-ounce ball that puts you in different positions and it forces different trunk stability requirements. So for me, they're two very similar but very different movements, and you're training different patterns to an extent. So it's actually good, if we can use the word here, cross-training. So I don't think the volume is really that big of an issue. A lot of our guys actually have their downtime, and we may do 2 to 6 weeks of, hey, I want you to do 20 minutes of throwing a football and running passing routes and just having fun being an athlete, but also you're still getting that eccentric stress on the shoulder. You're still getting the concentric stress as you're throwing. You're getting a little less of that elbow stress because you're not getting as far laid back and external rotation. So there's carryover, but the people that we typically see to be most healthy for pitchers, for instance, are high school football players and often quarterbacks. And it would be counterintuitive to think, oh, they have a lot more throwing on their arm, why are they healthier? They usually have more muscle mass and they're stronger, because if you're not bigger and stronger, you're going to get your ass kicked on the field. And in terms of those throwing patterns, you have more high quality reps. And one of the things we look for with our throwers is, I want to see guys ideally inside of 90 degrees of elbow flexion at front foot contact. So when we're looking at that, it's really difficult to be it's quite difficult to have a repeatable arm action, tight spiral, and consistency in accuracy with throwing a football at 15, 16 ounces if you're not inside of 90 degrees. But we see a lot of pitchers way outside of 90 degrees, and they have elbow issues. They're good cross-training drills. Volume is not something I'm too concerned about with those two things.
I just want to emphasize, because I have parents that are blowing up my DMs here about lay down. And so when I first discovered all these terms, it was when Tyler was beginning to get into that 14 to 16 year old window. And I remember very vividly, we were at an event out at USC, and Tom House took his fingers and literally stuck them. His hand almost disappeared in the scapula. So can you explain the whole deceleration, the muscle groups that are associated with that, and get into that, what that lay down means, if you can create a vision of what arm lay down and the 90
the layback. So if you think of a really high velocity pitcher, like a Aroldis Chapman, for instance, when he gets external rotation, that peak moment where his hand reaches behind him and it's almost like he's trying to reach for the ground behind him, that's where we get a lot of that valgus load on that UCL, so the front of the elbow. And that's where we see a lot of the issues. Now, that may be the symptom, but that's where we see a lot of the issues. That's where we're loading our external rotators of the shoulder, so our scap muscles, or our periscap muscles, our muscles around our shoulder blade, and allows to counter that, we have our pec in the front and our anterior shoulder muscles that are going to be pulling us forward when we go to throw. So those muscles are playing back and forth. And when you're throwing a football, you're not getting the same amount of layback that you're going to get with a baseball at high intent.
Could you explain the why or what the scapular or the decelerating muscles, what are those muscle groups and why are they important to throwing athletes?
Got it. Yep. So in terms of the decelerating muscles, the muscles, as you're going to follow through and reach that arm out in front of you when you're letting go of the ball, you're going to have your rotator cuff muscles, you're going to have your rhomboids, your lower trap, mid trap, upper trap are all going to be parts of the equation to allow your arm to slow down as you're going forward. Now, one of my big contentions and things that are, I believe, overlooked is we really zoom in deeply to the shoulder and into the shoulder musculature as the problems. Like, guys got a weak external rotator, a weak infraspinatus, which is a part of the rotator cuff. And for me, it's rarely the shoulder that is weak that is the problem. That might be, again, a part of the symptoms. But when you're going to throw, if a high level thrower that is going to throw the ball hard needs to be able to decelerate from their front post up leg, they need to be able to decelerate from their anterior trunk, so like their abs, their obliques, they need to be able to decelerate from their lower back and like erectors, so those thick muscles in the lower part of your spine. Your upper back needs to be able to decelerate. Your trunk needs to be able to be strong and stable in those positions. And then you need to ask those rotator cuff muscles and those external rotators of the shoulder, which are rotator cuff muscles, are typically the thickness of a like shoelace. So they're tiny in the grand scheme of things. Whereas like your butt and your quads, your abs, your lower back, these are big, strong muscles to help you decelerate. So they're all pieces of the equation. And a lot of times, people will go and get therapy. I have someone that came to me yesterday and they had a partial UCL tear. They were put in a cast for 2 weeks and they're now slowly rehabbing themselves back. And in 4 weeks, the doctors and therapists want them to start throwing. Well, they're doing all these isolated musculature movements for their shoulder, but they're not training their nervous system how it's going to function, or not training their brain how it's going to function on the field, where you have to brace your trunk, brace the legs, and actually decelerate from all of the musculature of the body that then will take the stress off the shoulder. Yeah, sure, little Timmy may have a weak shoulder, but little Timmy's weak shoulder is probably a byproduct of little Timmy being a weak human being.
So as the questions come in, I want to remind people, if you have a question, any question at all, you can direct message it to me. I will, if I get multiple similar text, I will paraphrase and put them all together. So Josh, the next question is coming in, and the parent wants to know, what is the big deal with why is core and lower half such a big deal for baseball players? She thinks it should just be for football. If baseball players are supposed to be fast and fluid and athletic, why is the emphasis now on all the lower half body core work?
Yeah, I think a very simple example is you're not going to see a race car with crappy tires, right? Whatever's going to connect to the ground, and in my opinion, it's not just the feet. It's our whole entire body is eventually connected to the ground because of your feet connect to your knees and connect to the whole entire chain all the way up. So you need to train the whole system. And that's where my work with the 90 mile an hour formula stuff, once we created it, once we figured out that we had a lot of validity to it, we started testing it. We have data that backs this, and we're planning on getting it peer reviewed, not this data, but running a whole other study to make sure that we have really good hard data we can stand on with this. But the interesting thing is, if you segment the body out and look at just the upper body versus the lower body or the trunk stability test that we have, we can find good correlations of reducing injury risk factors for someone to have a UCL reconstruction surgery. That's great. So you can say, we know that if you can do a chin-up, if you could do 13 chin-ups, we found 13 or more chin-ups, excuse me, we found that I believe it's 42% less likely to have a UCL surgery, which is fantastic. That's great. That's great information. But if you start layering that on our lunge metrics and our deadlift metrics, we're seeing that those numbers are 400-500% more likely to not have a UCL surgery. So those numbers are incredibly significant. And I did an in-service for Eric Cressy and his staff on this stuff. And one of the things that I brought that him and I both seemed to agree on was that the numbers are the numbers. Like, I don't really care if it's 300%, 500%, 10,000%. It doesn't really matter to me. What we know is there is a heavy correlation from those populations that we looked at between being strong in your lower half and significantly reducing your chances of a UCL surgery. The biggest number and the most unique metric of the whole thing was our reverse lunge number. So if you can reverse lunge 1.5 times your body weight in external load on a barbell back squat position, so barbell loaded, we found that your 98.3% increase chance of not having a UCL surgery. So you're saying you double your odds of not having that elbow surgery, which to me, I don't really care how people go about their training. As long as you're using your training and checking off these metrics in the process and you're following the way the body actually moves biomechanically, so making sure that the joints are moving the way they're supposed to, and you're loading the body the way you're supposed to, the way you're going to on the field, and your brain, your nervous system is training in those patterns, you're going to decrease your chances of injury. So there's a lot of carryover for all that, but it all starts with the ground. It all starts with the ability to absorb and transfer force.
So these questions, as they come in, are way over my pay grade. So if I say a word incorrectly, I just want to give you a heads up. But parents, you're doing a great job, and just keep sending these questions. I'll make sure that parents, people, folks that are listening, please keep sending them in. Okay, first one. Question for Josh. Does he use Aqua bags for co-contraction work? Your thoughts.
So I do not personally use them, but I have no issue with any of those types of products. We actually use, I call any of those products reactive stability products. So sometimes we'll load bands, chains on a bar. We'll do different variations of chains and bands. We may use some water apparatuses, but not those ones in particular. I call them reactive stability tools because you have to get into a position and you have to be able to have stability the whole time. So if you have to fight a dynamic movement of, say, sand, water, bands, or chains, your body has to make an immediate correction and will find the path that is most efficient to create those movement patterns. No, I don't use that product directly, but indirectly, I love all of those types of products.
Okay, follow-up question. Also, does he do any ocular vision training?
So we do some of it, but it's usually baked into our warm-ups and some of our exercise selection. There's definitely vestibular and ocular reflexes that we are implementing into our training, and that is absolutely a field that that we are getting deeper into, because I think the disconnect between the performance side and the rehab side, and really I view us as a rehab company that happens to do performance stuff because it's all on the spectrum of performance and rehab together. That is really where a lot of our training is going. The good thing is that we know with a lot of our drills from pre and post testing that the vestibular and ocular reflexes that we're trying to train are still getting trained with the way that we approach our athletes. And in the eye driver as a driver for our movement capacity is a huge one. It's something that is probably the most overlooked thing in all of sports performance, especially baseball.
So I want to make sure that all moms and dads that are listening and your sons are 13 or 14, a lot of this information, a lot of these terminologies that are coming at you, I when I used to hear them for the first time, I used to have to go out and get a drink of water and sit down and just take it all in, because sometimes it would go over my head, but inevitably Tyler would always figure this out and start to talk the same language. So in its simplest terms, a lot of the training now, even from 10 years ago, is so advanced because of people like Josh and their client and their trainers that work within their facilities. And this is the type of what I call separator for a lot of young athletes, is the strength and conditioning. Brian and I made a point to emphasize this in the book because it is truly the difference maker, the separator, that parents spend all these hours tracking other gadgets and gadgets and technology. And at the end of the day, strength, conditioning. And then my next topic for Josh, which I think is he's going to really hammer home here. When you're a throwing athlete, the importance of stretching and warm up, meaning a great guy out on the West Coast that used to coach at USC used to always use the terminology, don't throw to warm up to throw. So can you speak with regard to the warm up process, the stretching process, and how important stretching is for younger student, all student athletes, really?
Yeah, I think there's, your point is a really good one. I think most people don't, one the most wasted time in all of sports performance at the youth and intermediate levels is the warm-up. You have an opportunity. I tell our athletes and our staff every day, every time you walk into the gym, every time you walk into train, you have an opportunity to move more or less efficiently. And the warm-up is such a wonderful time that you can take 10, 20, 30 minutes to prepare your brain and your neurological system, as well as your musculature, for the tasks that are about to happen. So it's a great opportunity to do those things. Now, to counter that and slightly disagree with you, not in terms of warming up is bad, but you could be the best warmer upper in the history of warmer uppers and be super prone to injury because you haven't done the legwork prior to prepare your body for what's about to happen. And a nice example I like is if you look at like animals in the wild, like a cheetah isn't going to go get out there and do his active warm-up for 20 minutes before he goes and runs down and kills dinner. He's going to already be prepared for that because of how they move and because of they're doing this all the time. That's not to say that it's not something we should do, but a lot of times people are like, well, I do a really good warm-up. Okay, that is just like you guys showed in your book. It's these are all little pieces of the puzzle. I don't care if you warm up great every single day. If you've done absolutely nothing all off season and you haven't even prepared your shoulder and the rest of your body for what is about to happen on the mound, you're probably asking for something bad to happen or suboptimally. So that warm-up period is just a wonderful time where we can get the body moving better and increase the temperature of our body and know that we give ourselves the highest level of opportunity to be successful in not only repeating our mechanics and being healthy, but being, but having that longevity in that health.
Okay. We have a question that has come in reference to bicep pain. And is it called the insertion point?
Yes.
Can you speak about bicep pain after throwing? Is that something that is normal on younger student athletes?
Pain in general after throwing is not normal. There's a lot of different things that could be going on. I always say go and get checked out by a qualified therapist. And when I say qualified therapist, I mean someone that's probably dealing with hundreds of throwers a year, because they're going to know exactly what to look for. It could be a pec issue. It could be a bicep issue. It could be a bicep tendon issue. It could be an infraspinatus issue. It could be a trunk stability or neck mobility issue, or a lower leg strength issue. So that's why we look at all the parts. But if you are in pain, that is your body signal saying, hey, something is not right. And that's why for me, I am not really a fan of icing in like a post-game, post-throwing activity, because icing is an analgesic. Icing is a pain reliever. So if you need to relieve pain post-throwing, something is not right, and you need to get that figured out. So that's why I always tell guys, dig deeper. You got to go, got to figure out what the reason for that is.
Okay, the follow-up question from another parent is, my son is 14 years old, and after he throws a baseball, he seems to have persistent pain in the tricep area. Is this something that we need to be alarmed about?
So again, I think any kind of pain is anything that lingers more than and is a longer episode than a couple of days or a couple of outings is something that should be not alarming, but definitely should be evaluated. And I think one of the big things, and Walter, I'd be interested in your thoughts, because you have a very unique perspective as a dad that's seen it from the bottom all the way to the top, is I grew up being taught, and I'm 35 years old, I grew up being taught like, hey, listen, you need to communicate that you have issues, but you want to communicate with the trusted staff that you know will be there to help you and not throw you under the bus. And there's a fine line between being an athlete and a competitor and getting out there and saying, oh my God, I'm on 3 days rest and I got to go throw another 100 pitches and I'm just going to suck it up and be the ace and get the W, versus, hey, my elbow has been barking for a week and it bothers me when I go to pick up a glass of orange juice and it bothers me all the time. You need to have that rapport and relationship with the people that you're surrounded by. It shouldn't be a negative to go and seek out help in a second opinion. And that's why I like being in the private sector, because we are working for the athlete. So if an athlete comes to us and they say, hey, listen, I didn't want to go to my athletic trainer because my arm was bothering me and I didn't want them to shut me down, we can evaluate it, we can treat it, and we can see, is the issue something that's orthopedic that we need to send them back and say, hey, listen, you need to go see the doctor? Or it's, hey man, we can do a quick dry needling session on you and you'll be back throwing in 20 minutes. You're good to go. But you need to have that rapport, not just with the athletic trainers, but in the therapy staff, but also the coaches that you're working with, and know where the lines are drawn.
I want to say, as far as from a parental perspective for a throwing athlete, I am a big proponent, and I probably learned this the hard way with my oldest, but I'm a big proponent of establishing the guidelines, discussing them with your son, and making sure they understand, here's what the word progression means. We're in a cold weather state of the area, and I would always say, your first few outings, we're at 45 or 3 innings. And then we're going to build from there. And we're not going to go over 70 innings in a calendar year. So I would lay out some parameters. And both my boys were able to communicate to their coaches. But there were the occasions where the coaches are pushing and, hey, we need it. It's a big game. And you know, there's no such thing, at least I'm not aware of, any specific, you know, set of directions or guidelines that come with everybody's child. Your child's body is going to be unique based on how often they work out and so forth and so on. So my next question, coincidentally, happens to deal with, what advice would Josh give to a high school baseball coach trying to implement a year-long workout program for those types of, for student, his student athletes?
So my presentation at the World Baseball Coaches Conference this year was actually buying wins for $0. Now, I didn't end up making it because of some COVID conflictions, but basically, when we set those parameters out, we have high school, college teams all around the country that utilize our paid services and our free services. And they, regardless of if they're using the pay or free services, one of the great things that they do is they make it benchmarks known to their athletes and to their team very clearly of, hey, we're doing the lunge because of, we're prioritizing the lunge in our training because of this. We're prioritizing our chin up because of this. We're prioritizing our deadlift because of this. And all of a sudden, the culture immediately shifts because you give them an outline of what is expected and where we are going. And we have remote clients and remote teams that almost their whole entire starting roster in high school is sniffing 90, and every single one of those guys hits the baseline formula metrics. They just have arm mechanical issues that they need to work on to get them to that next step in terms of the velocity. But their injury rates go down, and they have very streamlined connection to their injury rates, their performance on the field, and then their wins. So when you're implementing something like this, my first thing is disseminate all the information to your team, give them all the tools, explain why you're doing it, and not just saying, like, we were told, hey, you're going to go to the gym, you're going to squat today, and you're going to bench. It's like, okay, like, I did it because I was told to, but had you told me, hey, this is a part of a system, the system's out there for free to use, and we are going to minimize your risk of injury, and we want to be looking for the upside in terms of your performance. That's the first thing. And the next thing is then making sure that you get your captains and leaders on the team on board, and then figuring out how you're going to implement that. And that is the way to build that as a culture, because I don't really care about what you're doing 6 weeks before your training and before the baseball season starts, because all the hard work has already either been done or hasn't been done. It's how are you going to maintain that from September to August, year after year, because that is how you're going to build a culture of winning and a culture of healthy athletes and a culture that is going to beget the juniors and seniors telling freshmen, grabbing freshmen by the hand and saying, hey, listen, kid, you spot up unbelievably with a 79 mile an hour fastball, and you have probably the best curveball in our whole entire organization, but you throw 79 and every one of our starters is 85, 86. You got to get your tail in with us because this will help you. And all of a sudden, those things start to change. And now the culture is different.
So as a parent of, when I remember vividly, can you speak to the young student athlete that enters into their first workouts or evaluations? It can be intimidating. Can you speak to that and how the younger student athletes navigate their way from the intimidation to absolutely embracing the routine and the structure that the strength training brings to them during that time period of the off season, of the September through the March or February?
Yep, for sure. I think, again, it goes back to a progression of where the athlete currently is, excuse me, and where they're going, and understanding that, excuse me, I got the hiccups, that they have, there is a natural progression in there, and everyone is on their own timeline. And the quicker that you can be indoctrinated into the culture of training and pushing yourself and understanding how your body works and moves and responds to different things, there is a learning curve. And that's why the quicker you can get an athlete under the guise of professionals that know what they're doing, it's such a valuable tool. And I even encourage parents to delegate that elsewhere, because even if you are a professional, like even my kids, like I don't expect to want to be the person that's holding the reins on everything, because you want an unbiased party that's going to be able to be tough and honest with them in critical times when they might just think dad's beating up on me, and when in reality dad might just be beating up on them, versus giving them actual structure and information to show them, hey, we're giving you tools. If you want to build a better house and foundation, and you want to be able to build a better fastball and body, or move more efficiently, or have a longer career, these are all the tools in our toolbox. Now let's figure out how to use them better. And the most notorious one that's abused and underused and misunderstood is nutrition. And the formula, we have our metrics are, you know, 2.5 times your height in inches is our quote unquote baseline for minimum body weight. So if I'm 5'9", so I'm 69 inches tall, my baseline weight, I think, is like 165 or something. My ideal weight is 2.75 times my height in inches or more. So 190-ish is that baseline for my ideal minimum body weight. So with those metrics, it's very easy to say, hey, athlete, you're 100 pounds underweight or 50 pounds underweight. no wonder why you can't compete with the kids that are 4 years older than you and weigh 100 pounds more than you, or the professionals that are out there doing it weighing, you know, 280 pounds and you're a buck 20. So giving them the tools and showing them that this is a process, not an end goal, that no one has ever finished training in nutrition. It's always about the process of getting better each and every day.
And can you speak to the benefit just for those student athletes that are listening? I have two parents that are listening with travel teams, the importance of sleep and water.
So sleep is probably the most powerful supplement known to man. I think that is probably one of the most misunderstood and powerful things that we can advocate for our athletes. I personally like having sleep trackers for some of our athletes that are trying to learn the process. I use a Whoop band. Some people use Oura rings. They're minimal investments. I think they're like 20, 30 bucks a month, but it gives you a good insight and a good talking point with those athletes of, hey, are you prioritizing these things? We know injury rates skyrocket from an athlete that gets 7 or more hours versus someone that gets 6 or less hours of sleep a night. And those are blind. Those studies are blind studies that just say, hey, how much sleep are you getting? What's your injuries like? And all of a sudden you see these massive correlations. We also know that everybody thinks they're building muscle size and strength in the gym. No, you are tearing down and teaching your body that it can handle load when you're in the gym. You're rebuilding outside of the gym when you're eating and sleeping. And sleep is a wildly powerful supplement. None of our teenage athletes should even have the remote thought of using any kind of like steroids or anything like that, because their testosterone, they're already on steroids. Their testosterone is like the highest that you'll ever see in most mainstream bodybuilders. Their numbers are there. It's how are you supplementing it with food, training, and nutrition, including water, and food, nutrition, water, and sleep. And how are you supplementing those things? If you're dehydrated, same thing comes into play. If you're, if you're 1% down, I forget the exact number, but I believe it's 1% down in body weight due to water loss, your injury rates go through the absolute roof. And so those are little things where if you're really a competitor and you're an athlete that wants to win and wants to be a part of a winning culture and produce the best that you possibly can, you're out there trying to flip every single stone to figure out what is your competitive advantage. I know we have guys, clients that come to us for usually one-off assessments, and they drive up in, you know, with their signing bonus money in a car, and then they're eating McDonald's. They're eating from the 99-cent menu. And to me, it's like, all right, I understand you're 23 years old, 25 years old. You're still trying to understand life. But buddy, like, you just put 200 grand into a car and you're putting 99 cents into your body. Like, that just doesn't make sense.
Preaching to the choir now. On that topic right now, I have at least 11 questions that pertain to, I am in the gym and I am trying to gain weight. Is there anything I can do to put weight on? So here is the question that I will put all these together with. My son is 16-year-old, 2023, PO. He is 6 foot, lives in the gym, weighs 153 pounds, tops out at 82 miles an hour. He is concerned about adding weight, not being able to add enough weight. What advice can you give him to gain 10 to 20 pounds?
This is where having an established relationship with a coach or a mentor is really important, because these are the hard conversations that people don't want to have. If I had a wonderful professor in college that used to say, if someone says to you they can't gain weight, you should grab them by the hand and run them up to Yale Medical Hospital and bring them in and say, hey, this guy's breaking the laws of thermodynamics, right? So the joke was you're not eating enough to gain weight, so you're not going to gain weight. It's very simple. It's a calories in versus calories out conversation. The hard truth is you are not prioritizing. That athlete has to come to the realization, and mom and dad giving them that realization is not going to go over too well usually. That athlete has to come to their realization from themselves, their peers, and their trusted staff that they have around them, knowing that they have not yet taken the steps forward to prioritize their nutrition and their recovery habits to allow them to add weight. We are just finishing up our weight gain challenge. We always do a weight gain and body composition challenge in the off season. So some people will try to gain weight, some people try to lose weight. We coach them through that. It's 12 weeks, and I don't have it in front of me, but I know our five finalists in that competition that were trying to put on weight were between 15 and I wanted to say 27 pounds. And some of them are already sizable athletes. So we do that regularly. In a 10-week window, we average 2+ pounds per week with our athletes, depending on where they are in their training and training history, off-season, in-season type things. So the hard truth is you're just not eating enough. And if you really want to throw harder and you want to be bigger and you want to put more power into the ball, you have to do the hard work that nobody wants to talk about, which is your relationship with food is never going to change. It is something that is always going to be there. I had a client, and a middle-aged gentleman who used to smoke like 2 or 3 packs of cigarettes, came into me, and he was a big boy. He was a very heavy guy. And he said to me, I asked him, I was like, you have your food issues. And you said you also had issues with your cigarettes. He goes, cigarettes was easy, man. He goes, I don't have to interact with cigarettes ever again. I quit cold turkey, three packs a day to nothing, because I never have to see a cigarette again. I don't have to hang out with people's cigarettes. I don't have to do anything related to cigarettes. He goes, but every single day I have to eat food, and that is not easy. So the relationship with food needs to be one that is introduced and really taken care of, because you get really one shot at doing it right.
Okay, the weight gain hack has always been chocolate milk, mashed potatoes, hard-boiled eggs at night. You got any hacks for these parents that are trying to put weight on their sons before the start of baseball season?
Yep. I often share 1,000 calories before 9 a.m. is one of my kind of gold standard rules. If anybody wants to look for more information, there's some on Instagram. There's a good amount on Instagram. There's a little bit on Twitter. I have a Prepare Like a Pro slide, basically, where it just talks about, hey, here's a couple of steps that you can do to really prepare yourself like a pro. The 1,000 calories before 9 a.m., there's a couple of unique qualities that are thrown into that and why we have that thing. So the first thing everybody asks me is, like, what should I eat? The first thing is, I don't want you to worry about what to eat. So if an athlete comes to me, I have a nice example from a parent that came in overzealous, and mom was like, he needs to put on weight right now. And it was like super overreacted. And I said, listen, we have a system in place. We're going to do all this stuff. And so finally, she was pretty irate that we were not going to handle it. And I said, all right, Timmy, what's your favorite food? And he goes, I don't really like much, but I like pizza. And I was like, okay, can you eat 1,000 calories worth of pizza before 9 a.m.? And his eyes lit up. He was like, yeah. And I was like, great. Awesome. And so mom was livid with me. And I said, listen, you got to let me do my thing. So he went 2 weeks. This kid had never trained with us, but had trained somewhere else. He went 2 weeks and put on like 7 pounds. And so mom's like, I can't believe he's putting on weight. I go, he's eating pizza. He's eating like a half a pizza every single morning. So I pull him aside and I said, dude, you're killing it with your weight gain stuff. You're getting stronger. You're getting bigger. Let's make it a little more nutritious. Like, you're eating like cheese pizza. Can we add some meat, some vegetables? He's like, I like beef on my pizza. I said, that's fine. I said, what about vegetables? And he's like, I can eat like peppers and onions and stuff on there. I'm like, great. So now we just added a protein and a protein with some fat, and we added some vegetables. Okay. That's not the worst thing in the world. So now he's up like another 5 pounds in another 2 weeks. And mom is like getting really angry at me again, because he's putting on weight, but like, he's eating pizza the whole time. And I pulled him aside. I was like, hey man, all right, you want to be a college athlete? And he's like, yeah. And this kid was 14 at the time, and his brother was a college athlete at the time. And I said, dude, you're eating pizza like literally like, all day. And he goes, I know. He goes, it's kind of awesome. I was like, all right, can we try to like get 1,000 calories into something different? What do you like? And he's, I could probably do an omelet. And within that conversation, we went from, I may be able to do an omelet, to he started eating an omelet with some toast and butter or peanut butter. He had avocado with it, and in his omelet, he would have vegetables in there. So now he's got like what represents a quote-unquote good breakfast, right? So he's got a lot of nutrition in there. He's eating a ton of calories before breakfast, excuse me, before school, before he gets to school. There's a backside to that too. It's not only have we just conditioned this kid to continually get enough calories and nutrients in, but we're doing it in a time frame where I pick 9 a.m. because that's enough time to get 2 to 3 feeding opportunities. And some younger kids just struggle with getting enough calories in the morning. And it's tough for them because they're basically running on battery acid in their stomach, having juice and sugar all day. So it takes a little bit for them to feel comfortable eating food. So they might get up at 6 in the morning and have 300-500 calories, and then they may bring a little snack to school, and then they have another snack before 9 a.m. to make that 9 a.m. clock. The other great thing with this is that now you're starting to change their circadian rhythm. So now, and that's just our body's process of saying, hey, what time is it? What time do we go to sleep? What time are we awake? What time are certain things supposed to happen? Your body is expecting, likes habits, and likes to expect things at certain times. So now this kid is no longer going to bed at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. He's going to bed at 10, 11, because he has to get up early. He needs enough sleep. So now he's getting higher quality of sleep. He's getting quality nutrients in the morning. And whatever happens the rest of the day, sometimes it's out of our hands. Like, we can only do so much when we're building these habits, but we've already built two amazing habits, which is increase your quality of sleep and quantity usually, and quality of calories. If he only gets one highly nutritious meal a day, and that's breakfast, I count that as a massive win. So it's about establishing those habits and having that support system, but also making sure that those habits are sustainable, because the last thing you want to do is put on 25 pounds in the off season to lose it on week one of, for our football guys, for 2-a-days, but for our baseball guys, they usually lose it by the time that their preseason is done with.
And on that note, I want to make sure I give 2 points of reference as a dad. I used to make protein drinks. And when I say protein drinks, they were basically a smoothie and a blender, anything and everything that, you know, Tyler and my oldest one liked, chocolate chip cookies, bananas, anything and everything. I went into a blender with some protein in it. And then we'd make a full blender. We'd drink half before we went to bed. And in the morning when we woke up, we had the remaining balance of that drink that we left in the refrigerator. And then we made sure that we had good-sized breakfast, whether it was Eggos and eggs or things. But the other thing is Metrex Colossal Bars. Metrex Colossal Bars. Those are your son's best friends. They're about 1,000 calories each, somewhere in that vicinity. They can be eaten while you're walking from class to class, and it helps with the hunger pain. And on that, now I have a question. What are Dr. Heenan's thoughts on creatine supplements to enhance strength training and weight gain for 13 to 14-year-old athletes?
By law, we are not allowed to give any supplemental advice. There's a lot of gray areas to it, but let's just go by the rules. The rules are you're not allowed to advocate for creatine for someone under 18 years old. Now, I'll tell you that if my son was 16 years old and had put on, my rule of thumb is 20 to 40 pounds of lean muscle mass from quality training and nutrition, and they are healthy and have no underlying issues, contraindications, liver, kidney issues, creatine is a highly studied and fabulous supplement with very little downside unless you have underlying issues. Creatine is found in other foods of ours, so it's not like you're taking in like a foreign substance. But notice I said 20 to 40 pounds of muscle mass before we actually implement that. And the reason is because people want the quick fix. And to go back to the previous question, and Walter, you brought up some good things about finding ways to just sneak calories into your kids' diets. That is absolutely, especially with growing athletes, you have to find a way just to get calories in for a lot of these guys, and ideally quality calories and minimizing the sugar. But the real big thing that people overstep with all of this, and I think it's really challenging for people to, they get so caught into the short term that they don't see the big picture. If an athlete wants to just throw a baseball hard, they may be incentivized enough to go out there and eat more and go to the gym and go home and eat steak and get to bed on time. Like, cool. But for most people with any audacious goals in life, whether it's baseball related or business or any kind of big goals, school, you have to go back and figure out what the goal is. And you have to backtrack and you have to figure out where is your North Star and are you moving towards it? And I think everybody works a little bit differently, but I think goal boards are really good. I think writing out goals are incredibly effective. The research says there people that write out their goals, I believe, are like 63% more likely to actually achieve them, which is an insane number to think about, that you writing it down on a piece of paper makes it real. The brain is a very finicky tool that we have, and it can be work for us or against us very hard. And I think most people overstep what is the ultimate goal. And if your goal is to be a big leaguer, then you should probably not hang out with the druggies in your school. You should probably show up to class on time because you want an opportunity to extend your career as long as you possibly can and make sure that you get good grades so you can go to college and have another 2 to 4 years to play. You should probably go to bed somewhat on time. You should probably go to the gym. You should probably make sure you're eating enough. Like, all these things are part of it. But unless you have that North Star, it's very easy to get sidetracked by friends doing fun things or by people not prioritizing school to make sure that your grades are up or not getting that nutrition in or not getting to sleep on time. A lot of those things for a parent is going to be like pulling teeth. Unless you have that North Star. And Walter, I've followed Tyler since Eric and I have known each other for a while now. And when I was finishing undergrad is when I really got indoctrinated to a lot of the stuff that he was doing. And it was right on path with where I was going. But I got to follow a part of Tyler's journey. And just from an outsider's perspective, it seems you guys did a really good job at least having goals in place and showing that there is a North Star. And yeah, you may have to modify how you get there a little bit every once in a while. But if the North Star is the North Star, then like you got one thing and you got to be moving towards it. And if you're moving towards it, it's a lot easier to veer off path and still be on path.
Thank you very much for that assessment, Josh. It's kind of you to say that. I will tell you that when parents are listening to Josh, I'm just going to interject viewpoint from the parent that's gone through this. And the point I want to make is we as parents miss the weight of all of these decisions that our sons are making on a day-to-day basis, on a daily basis. When a student athlete has that sense of purpose and they make that decision internally and then externally with regard to their habits and their action steps, you tend to eliminate a few of your peers. And we have to remember that in some cases or most cases, these kids grow up together from kindergarten and elementary school. And then we get to junior high / middle school. And before we enter into high school, you're making decisions to make changes to your body. You're making a commitment to you as an individual, the routine and the structure. Mom or dad have to make a commitment to drive and get to these facilities. In our case, it was about a 45-minute drive 5 days a week. And Tyler played football while going to Cressy 4 or 5 days a week. So my point is, there's a lot of decisions that student athletes are making on a daily basis, what they're putting in their body, who they're hanging out with, as Josh alluded to, how much sleep they're getting. And so we have to be cognizant of that. We have to discuss that because as a parent, hey, did you take your vitamins? Hey, did you eat? What did you eat today? When's the last time you ate? In their back of their brains, they're trying to say, today I had a tough day. My buddies no longer, they're making fun of me. I'm eating all the time. I'm going to the gym. Who do I think I am? I'm never going to get out of here. I'm never going to play college athletics. And it's all of these things that the student athletes at very young ages have to deal with. And it's a weight that they carry on their shoulders. So be very cognizant of that, because when you're in the weight room, it can be intimidating, not so much from the amount of weight that you're lifting, but you look around and you see men. And then the boys go home and they're in the mirror. And I just saw a 21-year-old guy and here I am at 14 and I'm only lifting 100 pounds and he's lifting 300. So there's a lot of things that go on mentally with student athletes that we have to learn to talk about and be aware of. When I'm talking about this stuff, Josh, one of the kind of tie-in questions here from a couple parents is their high schools will not allow them to work out in season or to work out with their trainer or with their off-season trainer. How are student athletes or should student athletes continue their workouts during their playing seasons?
So that's a tricky one, because I always want our athletes to be team players. And if someone comes to me and says, hey, my team is doing team workouts, I really want to train with you guys. I basically, it's notorious with the football programs, because those guys usually do a pretty good job of hurting their athletes to stay together. They're like, I don't want to miss my football workouts. What am I supposed to do? And I'm like, hey, man, do the best you can with your football workouts. Maybe we can supplement some stuff here and there. Maybe you can get in once in a while. Or maybe we can just add in some modifications to some of the things you're doing, just to make sure that you're on a better track than just blindly doing a program that someone writes on the board. That being said, if you're going to remove training altogether year-round, or even in season, probably arguably the most important time to utilize training, there, you have to. That's going to be a personal, very personal situation and conversation that needs to be had. And that's why parents really need to be in tune with what's going on all around, from the middle school all the way up to the high school guys, in understanding what the programs are like. Because not saying that you would want to pull a kid out of a school because, oh, the coach doesn't let them work out, whatever. That's not necessarily what I'm saying. But also, you want to surround yourself in a situation for your athlete to thrive. And if you know that they're not going to be able to thrive under that situation, that may be a conversation, a good sit-down conversation with the family, and then maybe worth having the conversation with the coach as an outsider when your kid is in seventh or eighth grade, and asking them why, or finding a local professional. If someone was local to us and they were like, hey, we have our athletes that want to come to you, but would you mind, you know, chatting with the coach and seeing what's going on? And a lot of coaches, I always say that the most coaches are out there to win games, right? They want to win games. They really do have their heart in the right place in terms of wanting what's best for the team. A lot of times coaches just don't know what's best, or it's hard to be objective when they were taught something, and they may just be closed-minded, or they may have had a bad experience. If your first athlete that you let go to a training facility takes a weighted ball and blows out his elbow, yeah, I'd probably have some trauma too, where I wouldn't want my athletes to go and throw a weighted ball. But at the same time, like, you need to build perspective around that. And that's a really challenging conversation, but something that you want to get ahead of long in advance. And I think you were talking about, Walter, you're talking about the younger athletes and all the kind of things that they have to navigate through that you're not a part of on a day-to-day basis. As a finely tuned parent of 3 years who probably knows nothing, but I get to see a lot of things from the athletes that we interact with all the time. And I see things with how my friends and peers have evolved over the years. You can't really control what your kids are going to do. I think we all know that. It's like, at some point they're going to do what they're going to do, but you can navigate them and put them in situations that will allow them to build their circle of good people. Now, I know I was not a perfect child by any means, but I had a good circle of people, and I had a really good circle of friends that always looked out for each other. And those people are still around in my life today, and they still probably navigate me out of stupid decisions that I'm about to make. But those are the people that are going to make the big impacts. And one of the greatest hacks out there, and you were asking for a nutrition hack earlier, one of the greatest hacks you can possibly do as a parent is get them surrounded by the people that they want to be surrounded by, and also that you believe can help build them into better people. So for instance, we have a couple of big leaguers in our facility. Some are big names and some are not. And then we have a whole bunch of minor leaguers. And then we have a whole bunch of college guys. Our minor leaguers, anybody that has crossed the chasm of being a professional in our facility is at some level pretty highly picked by us, because we want to curtail a nice environment where a 12-year-old kid can walk in and talk to a big leaguer and know that person will treat them like a human being, and also a peer that wants to be better at their sport. It's really easy for a parent to say, hey, you got to go eat your breakfast, eat your 1,000 calories before 9 a.m. It's really easy for me as a strength coach or a performance coach or therapist to go and say, hey, listen, you're not reaching towards your goals what are you doing? Like, we got to reevaluate, and how are we going to get those 1,000 calories in? If you become friends with a big leaguer and he turns to you and says, hey, Timmy, why are you being such a wimp? Why don't you go and eat breakfast? Otherwise, you're never going to be able to throw hard, and like shoves it on them as like a peer and a friend and also someone that they respect. Let me tell you, that is going to go a lot further than anything myself or your parents are going to say.
Now, I'm going to double up on that because I can attest to that. When Tyler was 6'2", 155 pounds, and at the time a Cy Young Award winner, a lot of college guys, a lot of major leaguers, including a guy by the name of Curt Schilling, not to go down that road, but he was surrounded by mentors that basically allowed him to understand what it really took. The consistency, the persistency, being persistent and knowing your course and sticking to your course. And I think that is an integral part of the strength and conditioning is the mentors that surround our student athletes, our children, and the positive influences in the decisions that they make in their high school years. I think that's a very valuable asset of the strength and conditioning, especially in that environment. So now a follow-up question is, a college student, a health and science student, is there a way to balance competitive summer baseball with a summer internship?
For us, we do it all the time. We have guys, so we're pretty close to Danbury. So we're close to the NECBL. We have guys that are in Mystic. And then we have other guys playing in other local leagues. But yeah, we have people come in quite regularly and do internships with us. I think it just depends on it's, as you said, Walter, before, chasing multiple rabbits at the same time. It's difficult. You can do it. You absolutely can do it. But if you're going to be a Cape Cod player and you have that caliber talent, I would wait for the internship after college or until you have a winter break that is conducive for you being a part of something like that, because you want to soak up those experiences too. And those are once in a lifetime opportunities. You can get an internship any day of the week. I think in terms of balancing it with a lower end or mid tier summer program, absolutely. There's plenty of room for that. But I think your baseball career, Wayne and I have done many seminars and stuff together. And one of his great opening lines is, and I'm probably going to butcher it, Wayne, so don't kill me, but it's basically like, what level do you think most high school baseball players are like destined to be at? And he basically comes back and says, high school baseball players, because most of them are D4 baseball players. They're not good enough to play in college. Your baseball career and your competitive baseball career is going to be very short. So you, in my opinion, you want to ride that as hard as you possibly can. If you think that there is, if you're getting enjoyment out of it, if it's building you into a better person, helping build connections, things like that, and also helping build potential career, it's a no-brainer to omit those things. But if you're trying to be in between and you're like, hey, I love my D3 ball and I want to get an internship, you can definitely balance a mid to lower level summer ball with an internship.
Okay, I'm going to call this like the lightning round because we just got 6 questions submitted. So I'll read them off to you and we'll try to get to them as best we can here. What are the best suggested methods to lose weight? My son is 16 years old. He is 6'4", 225 pounds. Growth plates still open. He has struggled with Osgood-Slaughter's disease.
Yep, Osgood-Slaughter's.
For 12 months, hasn't been able to run until now. Also, do you recommend working out with open growth plates?
The growth plate dilemma is something that we had earlier on in my life in terms of that was something that was really brought to the forefront of, hey, you don't want to load yourself heavy when you have open growth plates. That has been debunked pretty consistently. We could make some arguments on weighted balls in growth plates and curveballs in growth plates on the elbow, but outside of that, you want to load athletes up as soon. My 3-year-old, soon to be 3-year-old, grabs a kettlebell and does squats sometimes, not from my pushing. He just grabs them and wants to copy what I'm doing. I have no issue with loading. So that's the first thing. The second thing is with weight loss stuff. So you said the kid's about 6'2", 220. That could look very different depending on each athlete. So the first thing I always say is that's actually, if you look at like the size that you want our higher level athletes to be, that's a pretty darn good size. Now, I always go back to, can they do a chin-up? Can they do a proper push-up? Can they reverse lunge their body weight for reps? Can they deadlift 400 or 500 pounds? The hardest thing that most people will go through with this is getting – they will try to lose weight. So the kid cuts down to 180. Now he's 6'2", 180. He lost all of his strength and power because he dropped 40 pounds, and now he's no longer a competitive athlete. And that leads to all sorts of other problems, and then yo-yoing back into his dieting. In terms of the Ozgin slaughters and what it sounds like the real summary of all this should be, I would highly recommend going to find a therapist that treats that on a regular basis. We have a very good track record in our staff to getting people with Ozgin slaughters cleared up very quickly, like handful of sessions, because of what's happening at the quads and the patellar tendon. So their knee is no longer tracking properly, and they're just really tight in their quads and they don't have good trunk stability. The nice thing is that you can layer that with good training, and good training will help you move better, will help you elicit potentially losing some fat mass, increasing muscle mass, and then optimizing your body, and then working on nutrition as a concurrently with that training. So there's a lot to unpack there, but this is one of those things, you can't be messing around with someone on Twitter Spaces saying, hey, this is what you should do. You should go seek out someone and figure out the root cause and figure out a solution.
Vanessa, did you have a question that you'd like to ask to Dr. Heenan? Okay, well, she's waiting. Well, I'm waiting for her. I'm going to ask the next question. After baseball season has ended, should a baseball player shut it down from throwing activities completely for a set amount of time? And if so, for how long? How long should they do it before ramping back up for next season as a high school age player?
So again, it's all in a progression of where they are physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, and progressing as an athlete. So if you're, for instance, a ninth grader that is the ace on your freshman team and the ace on your summer ball team, getting a ton of innings, you're 50 pounds underweight, and you're throwing a lot of curveballs, I would like to see that athlete take 6 to 12 weeks off from throwing completely and focus on playing another sport, adding 30 to 50 pounds to their frame, and just becoming a better overall athlete. Now, if you're a senior in high school who is coming up on like the biggest year of their career and potentially getting drafted, and then going through those things, I don't think that the shutdown needs to be as long if they are a full grown man. And I think I think a part of this is, some of this is, we complicate so difficult. So we make this so complicated that it's hard to digest. Does your kid look like an MLB big leaguer? Clayton Kershaw probably doesn't have to shut down too much. Curt Schilling in the offseason probably didn't have to shut down too much. Those are full grown men that move weight in the gym, move well, and consistently are taking care of their bodies like professionals. If little Johnny is 120 pounds soaking wet and can barely do a push-up, that is a very different human being. Build the athlete first and then let them become a specialized player.
A lot of parents and student athletes are caught off guard if they do have the ability to become a college student athlete. Can you speak to the differences or the expectations with regard to strength training routines from high school and then those going into college? Just speak of the demands of the college student athlete and how they should be preparing as high school student athletes.
Yeah, so the baseline formula metrics in terms of your lunge, deadlift, chin-up baselines are set to maximize, be the bare minimum to maximize your ability as a human being that moves. So those are the first things we always try to check the boxes on. We have athletes that are 14 years old and that hit all the formula metrics. And as I said before, we have guys that are 100-mile-an-hour throwers coming off of Tommy John in the big leagues or about to be in the big leagues or in the big leagues and don't come close to sniffing half the metric. That's the first baseline. In terms of how to prepare for that, I want to see athletes training 2 to 3 times a week year-round no matter what, bare minimum. If you're not willing to do that, then I don't think that you have the commitment and the preparation to do that in the college setting yet. And thus you probably shouldn't be trying to get to a higher tier college program, because most college programs are going to spend 3 to 4 days a week in the off season and then 1 to 3 days a week in season with training. So it needs to be a year round endeavor if that is something that you want to make a priority.
That is, I, to me personally, as a parent, that's critical information for those student athletes that have the desire and the passion to try and play at the collegiate level. And I can assure you the division of the college has no bearing. I know LSU Eunice, their strength and conditioning program is very intense. And a lot of student athletes roll in there thinking, it's just a JUCO. And then they get, they're out there trying to do things and they just aren't prepared for it. So you can't prepare enough for the strength and conditioning component as it relates to being a college student athlete. Strength is and always will be a separator. It helps with health. It helps you maintain your day-to-day routines. It's just a critical component to being a student athlete. And those student athletes and parents that neglect that and try to play catch up as a senior in high school, my son weighs 150 and he throws 81 and I want him to throw 100. It's not going to happen in 12 months. So preparing for that at an earlier age is definitely going to pay dividends throughout your high school career leading into college. This question is a little advanced, but I want to be able to get it out there. Do you, Josh, assess tricep and bicep size mass, and is there a decrease in energy transfer if the bicep is overly massed compared to the triceps? Should players balance these two muscles out?
We do not directly take those measurements unless it's really indicated. So if someone comes in and has like a significant issue, that'll be something we dig further into, but that is not something we normally assess. But what I will say is that we do assess balance of strength, and usually strength, both concentric, eccentric. So pulling it up like a bicep curl, pulling up to your face is concentric. Eccentric is letting that bicep get long and go away from your body. We do constantly balance our training with those types of movements to make sure that we have balance between the front and the back of the body, or rotationally, or all sorts of different components with that. I am most concerned with strength because it's something very easy that we know we can manipulate. So it's something that we're not just taking information and take information. We're putting that information to use right away. The second piece to that is there's a lot of interesting nuances with throwers. So I threw all the way into college and in JUCO, and then Wayne Mazzoni cut me, if he's still listening. But that's besides the point. But what we have noticed is that there's neurological issues with people on their throwing side. So for instance, my right bicep has always been smaller than my left bicep. Now, my right bicep is slightly weaker and has always been slightly weaker, but it's not something I'm super worried about because the balance is relative. So we have to take those things into account. So it's not something we dig into unless there's an orthopedic component.
I want to say thank you to you, Josh, because this has been absolutely tremendous. I can't tell you the number of comments that, let me give you one, just I'm not trying to blow smoke, but this gentleman is absolutely tremendous. Unfortunately, I live in Tennessee. How can I work with somebody like Josh if I live in Tennessee, he's in Colorado, and his businesses are in Connecticut?
One, you can always search out people that are highly qualified locally in your area. If anybody has any questions on that, feel free to, I think anybody has any questions on any of this stuff, if you ask those questions in the thread attached to this Spaces and just tag me in it, I'll gladly go back in. I'll answer. I might not answer them right away, but I'll answer them in the next day or so. Happy to try to help find someone locally. We do offer remote programming. We have clients all around the world, and we have thousands of athletes that we work with each year, both on site and remotely. And as a little sales pitch, it's called the 90 mile hour formula training platform on our advanced therapy and performance website. I can link that up too later if you'd like. We charge $50 a month for customized programming based on the needs of those athletes that we do a full assessment on. So that is an easy way to leverage being somewhere where you don't have access to those professionals locally. I think that there's good and bad with being on-site versus remote, and the on-site services are usually a wonderful opportunity to build that personal connection. And if you have a lot of different moving parts that you want to have, like that person with the Ogden Slaughters, that's someone that would be a really good candidate to be an on-site client of someone locally with you. But if you have access to a gym and you're looking for inexpensive programming that's top tier, then, you know, that's what I would recommend people look at.
So if you're trying to follow, and I don't know if everybody here has asked me, Josh, if you want to give your website, your Instagram, because I have parents that are asking if you do a blog that I know you do. So if you want to give people that information now, that would be great.
Yep. So my Instagram is at Dr. Heenan, H-E-E-N-A-N, just as it is on Twitter. Twitter is Dr. Josh Heenan. But my personal website is just joshheenan.com, and advancedtherapyperformance.com is our company website. Instagram's where most of my content is. We have most of our like premier content is, as well as our email list. So we probably have a couple thousand posts on my account and our ATP account on Instagram as well, where we really do a lot of deep dives. That information is all obviously free on there, but I answer basically every question in the comments. I try to be super transparent. The baseball community baseball has been really good to me my whole entire life, and there's a lot that I can give back, and this is one of the ways. So I'm always happy to help, and I'll try to be really direct with people. And if I can be of assistance, great. Sometimes for a lot of these people, it's literally, you got to go to the next level and get assessed to make sure that you're catering your needs and goals to the program that you're on, or the particular situation that you're in. I encourage everybody to either reach out on here or Instagram, or shoot me an email. And definitely, if you need to find help finding someone local, I'm happy to help with that as well.
So Josh, I want to, on behalf of Brian and Butch, mentors, and all these parents, I literally just had 67 people, and I'll paraphrase. Josh has been fantastic. I learned a ton listening to this space. So that's the gist of the feedback that we're getting. So I want to say thank you. I do know that we did this on a Thursday. We didn't do it on a Monday. This will be available via the podcast as they always are. Again, you have access to Josh via multiple avenues, via direct social media. I want to let people know about our upcoming space on Sunday, which is going to be jam-packed. It's going to be Jay Johnson, the new coach at LSU, formerly of Arizona, formerly of University of San Diego. This will be a highly anticipated and something you're going to learn a lot from, because he's one of the best college recruiters in the country. On Monday evening, we're going to have the head coach of West Point University, Jim Foster. And this is an interesting topic because the military component is often misunderstood, and a lot of parents get lost in the service time and things of that nature. But this is a really great opportunity for those parents and student athletes that want to learn about post-grad schools, what they mean and how they work, as well as how the military academies recruit, the conferences that they play in. For Army and Navy, it's the Patriot League. I think Air Force is in the WAC, I think. But that'll be a good opportunity. And I want to announce the following Monday, we will have Tim Corbin from Vanderbilt University. That will be on Valentine's Day. That will be February 14th. I can't emphasize enough that this is not a gentleman that is usually available due to these platforms, but he's making some time for us prior to the season starting. The following Monday, we're going to have Ben McDonald on February 21st. And then on February 28th, I'm going to have John McCormick, the head coach, FAU. So we're going to have a lot of college coaches that are going to be joining us. I'm pulling up Butch's now because I know Butch has a schedule after Jay Johnson. So what I want to be able to let people know is, if you have questions in advance for these types of coaches, please send them ahead of time to us via direct message to either Brian, Butch, or myself. You can email us via our website, which is mentorsofbaseball.com. We have a free newsletter, free, F-R-E, free, that has some content similar to what Josh gave us this evening, but we talked to various people within the world of baseball for 20 minutes. They share some questions. We ask them questions from parents' perspectives, and they give us some answers. That's available via the newsletter. All of our podcast information, both former podcasts, upcoming podcasts, those are available via the newsletter. It's a free newsletter. You just have to go over to Mentors of Baseball profile on Twitter. And once you click on the profile, you'll see the sign up for the newsletter. Last but not least, I would say on average, all three of us, Butch, Brian, and myself, in some way, shape, or form are asked, how can you help us as a family? Can we work with you as a family? Can you help us navigate the process with our son? And so what we did is we basically set up a program for less than a cost of a baseball bat on a yearly basis. You can work with us via the new software app, Volley, which is a video-based app that allows you and Butch and Brian and myself to interact via video. We see you, you see us, we get to see who you are, you get to see who we are. More importantly, we get to see your videos of your son moving. And this is a platform that I think will provide service for a lot of student athletes and families. You don't just get an email and then you get ghosted, as my son would call it. We actually are interacting with student athletes and parents at all hours of the day. Not that I'm advocating 2 a.m. text messages, but this is a platform that I believe if you are a parent and you want access to a major league scouting evaluation, college recruiting information, equipment, et cetera, we're going to be able to have those answers and we're going to provide you those answers. So when you go over to Mentors of Baseball, you'll see there's a membership platform. If that's something that you're interested in, we're making that available. Download the Volley app. It's worth its weight in gold. And I'm not technology savvy, but we interacted today, Butch and I, with two 12-year-olds. And you might say to yourself, why in the heck are you guys talking to 12-year-olds? These 12-year-olds were so full of energy and so much passion for the sport of baseball. Both Butch and I laughed because these boys were just sponges. And they have an idea of what they want to do and where they want to go. And it's their words, not dad's, not mom's. It was their words. And they were looking directly into the camera when we were doing our Zoom calls, which is another component, where we introduce ourselves and the student athletes and the parents get to introduce themselves and we have a dialogue. And we let them know that anytime they have a question, all they have to do is send us a volley and we're going to interact with them. So we've made that available for parents. That's strictly an option that you can choose. The newsletter, again, is completely free. It gives you all the podcast information. All of the other components to the membership is all there on the website. So take a look. If you have a question, reach out and let me know. Remember now, Butch is 9 p.m. Eastern time on Sunday with the LSU head coach, Jay Johnson. So we have Jay Johnson, Jim Foster, West Point. We have Butch, help me out. Who's going to come on before Corbs on February 14th after Jay Johnson?
I got Jerry Weinstein, the guru of coaching of all positions and highly successful coach, coached Team Israel. And I've known Jerry for years, and he is the best guy in the country, in my opinion, coaches. And then I have Dayton Moore the following week, the president, former general manager of the Kansas City Royals.
So just so everybody understands, this is the content that we allow all parents and student athletes to have access, but more importantly, availability. So when we interact with these coaches and these gentlemen like Dr. Heenan and Eric Cressy and so forth and Dayton Moore, they're answering your questions. They're answering your concerns. And that is what Mentors of Baseball is all about, giving you access, providing you availability to these types of gentlemen and women that give us their time and share their wealth of knowledge. And just a little insight, I don't know if a lot of the parents that joined us tonight were on the phone when we did our Twitter space with Dr. Brett McCabe. We're going to have some content with Dr. McCabe via our newsletter on a regular basis. And if you listen to Dr. McCabe during his previous two appearances with us, He's a pretty special guy. Not only was he a former LSU baseball player, but he works at University of Alabama, and he's just offers such tremendous insight. And we're going to basically give him a question maybe once a month and have him answer it for us on the platform of the newsletter. That's a surprise for Brian and Butch. I just set that up. So we're going to do those types of things going forward. So spread the word. Sunday night, Butch, Athlete 911, part of the Mentors of Baseball, going to have arguably one of the hottest coaches right now in college baseball, Jay Johnson, because he's taken over a storied program at LSU. And then Monday evening, West Point head coach Jim Foster. We'll have several other head coaches, but the night belongs to Jimmy Foster. And I look forward to talking with everybody on Sunday and listening to Butch's Twitter space. And thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight.
Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please make sure to visit our website at playballkid.com or join us live next week on the Mentors of Baseball. If you're looking for more information, please check out our book, Committed, on Amazon, or message us to learn more about the Mentors of Baseball.